All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Gym Fear 138 podcast. Today, finally, hopefully with no technical problems or anything like that, we have the editor of the Pulp Rev Sampler and the upcoming Swords of St. Valentine anthology, Jesse Abraham Lucas. Jesse, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's nice to be here. Virtual studio.
So, last time we had this big, long discussion that unfortunately was completely unusable because of, like I said, technical difficulties, but...
I just don't think you can contain me is the problem.
That might be it. That might be it. Hopefully we can get that worked out this time, though, because it would be a shame if these great conversations didn't get broadcast to the people.
Would be. They are great.
But I think last time that we had started out with platforms like, say, Discord or Twitter, that were kind of hostile to, not necessarily right-leaning, because the Pulp Rev really isn't exactly right-leaning.
The Pulp Rev isn't really a right-wing organization. It's full of right-wingers, including me, but it is politically agnostic. And a lot of people would say that means it's going to this territory eventually. And stability, but I think there's enough political diversity to keep it at least as long as I'm in there. Real powers over everybody and bending them to my will.
Manipulating from the background like the Machiavellian genius you are. Yeah, so far as political agnosticism, that's one of the things that I really like about the Pulp Rev, is that it's not, you know, people aren't really trying to push politics necessarily with their fiction, which is something that I notice a lot of other movements in literature are trying to do, and the fiction just never seems as, I don't know, just as real or as earnest as it does in the Pulp Rev. You know, even the lower quality stuff, I would say, is better than, you know, the stuff that's explicitly there to preach a message.
And you, message fiction is not bad. It's not a bad thing. It can get cloying. You can have too much of it, and you can very easily let the message swallow up the rest of the story. And that's the biggest problem. It's not that they have a bad message. Well, they do. They do have a bad message. I don't agree with it at all. But they don't have a good story with it. Good story is a little bit more complicated than just, you know, being entertaining, right? There's a lot of factors that go into it. There's a lot of mystery about what it is, a lot of study that still needs to go into what makes some stories good and some stories bad. You can't really set up a computer to make good stories.
Yeah, I mean, you can set up a computer to make interesting stories, but, you know, it's interesting for an entirely different reason than something like, I don't know, the Conan stories are interesting.
And as far as... politics goes, I guess Pulp Rev is about the options. Necessarily having, like, an example I bring up is there was a King Arthur anthology a while ago, and people were talking about, we're going to do King Arthur on motorcycles, but, oh, I'm going to do King Arthur on hover bikes, and I'm going to do King Arthur with Mecha, and I don't think anyone wanted to just do King Arthur on horses. It feels like there's this some part of the movement where people think they're required to make things outlandish. They just have the option.
I mean, I'm guilty of that. You know, I like the outlandish stories. I like the stuff that people really haven't played with before or don't play with very often. I think that adds a little bit of fun and wonder to the story when you come into the story and you're seeing something that, you know, nobody in the Big Five is doing anything like this, even if it's just King Arthur with mechs, you know.
Two things about this. Taking an old story and making it outlandish isn't exactly new. Maybe it hasn't been done that outlandishly in that way, but the core of what makes a story different and interesting, I think, lies a little bit farther away from the setting, and it's how the characters interact with it. It's how the characters interact with each other. And as for another point, one of the beauties of the old pulp masters is that we didn't know if they were going to make it outlandish. You start one of these short stories and you don't know if they're going to be throwing planets at each other by the end of it. Because the option is there, because they might just as easily make just a, you know, a neat story about World War II. But
yeah, there were plenty of old pulp stories about like fighter plane pilots and things like that. But
they keep you guessing. You don't know if the fighter plane pilot's going to, like, I read one where he there's a stray planet breaks through the Earth's atmosphere and the fighter pilot lands on it, and he wasn't a fighter pilot, but anyway, he lands on it and has a little bit of an adventure on this stray planet that's in the Earth's atmosphere for a couple hours. The stories before and after that were regular old aviation stories, and so I think there's a sense of wonder there that you can only have when you've got a broad range of possibilities. And I guess the broad range of possibilities could include a lot of outlandish things, but
being outlandish shouldn't be a goal in and of itself.
What I'm saying is that excitement when you find out that you stumbled into fairyland isn't as palpable when you go that isn't fairyland.
When you have a what? Sorry, you broke up a little bit.
Have anywhere to go that isn't a fairyland. When everywhere's Disneyland, nowhere's Disneyland.
Oh, I feel you. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, if every story has to be more outlandish than the last, then you swiftly run into DBZ syndrome, where, you know, every arc has to be bigger and better than the last one, or every story has to be crazier than the last one. And I like crazy outlandish stories. But at a certain point, it's kind of nice to read something that's a bit grounded in reality, you know?
A lot of the problems with modern-day fiction, I think, are kind of counterintuitively based on scope creep. And, you see, like Jeff Vandermeer, he's a new weird author, and he has incredibly interesting premises for his novels. I mean, go to Amazon sometime, look up a Jeff Vandermeer novel. This mushroom city where like there were mushroom people underground and they came up out of the sewers and took over, and now they're kind of communists ruling the place and putting mushrooms in people's heads so that they can spy on their friends and stuff. And it looks really interesting, but everyone I've talked to that's actually read a Jeff Vandermeer book says it's really boring. But he's crept away from having anything conventional, and now he just does his postmodern nothing really means anything stuff with that. On the other hand, things like Saving the World, in conversations with on Twitter he's Tristan Severs, on the Discord he's Irachima, but I've had some conversations with him and the other guys about when Saving the World became a common plot thread. The stories in the 1800s about saving the world, but you pull up a random Doctor Who episode, and you know, two out of three times it's going to be about saving the world. At some point,
you're right about that.
They raise the stakes too much, and now they feel like they can't lower them without making it boring.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I really like about the old Doctor Who, specifically the first run with William Hartnell, is that not every story. I mean, they had a couple of world savey stories, but your average, you know, standard Doctor Who story in the very first run in like 63 was, okay, we are in prehistoric Earth now and we have to deal with these cavemen, or, you know, we are in Alexander's train, you know, we have found Alexander the Great and we're just kind of journeying with him for a while because he's, you know, he's taken the TARDIS hostage, he wants to give it to an emperor. And visiting the Mayans for, you know, four episodes.
And I mean, there's still episodes like that in New Who, and they don't always have to save the world, but they do a little much, and they always have to save something. And there's always some baby in danger or something, and there are quickly fine stories and story concepts that don't involve stakes that high. And just like with the other thing we just talked about, when you always have high stakes, you never have high stakes.
You can't write about the world getting destroyed every week. No one will want to follow that if there's just these downer stories.
Yeah, and I mean, like, even with the world, you know, the world-saving stories, like, I'm working on one now where, I remember I was watching a Justicar video where he was talking about gun control, of course, but he was talking about tyrants and how stopping Hitler at the beginning of his rise to power would have been just as significant at stopping him when we actually did stop him in World War II. You know, if you can stop the guy who's trying to take over the world and do all of this really evil shit before he really gets going, it's just, you still save the world. It's just as significant, even if the actions are on a much smaller scale. So something like the Battle of Athens is just as significant a historical event as, you know, stopping Hitler in some respects. So not everything has to have these huge, oh, we know this guy is going to destroy the world, or we know this guy is going to take over civilization and turn it to his evil designs, you know. Maybe he's just...
Especially, you know, as far as how we respond to the story goes, the Battle of Athens is really, really interesting because it's, you know, it's a little outlandish. It's something you don't often hear about, is a bunch of disgruntled veterans running a mayor out of town, and you can think, oh, I'm done with all these old sorts of stories, add magic to it, but the story of the Battle of Athens, it kind of adds magic to it. Takes familiar elements and recombines them in interesting ways, and of course, you know, it's a true story, so
yeah. And there is the certain level of heroism there in the guys who were fighting against the sheriff and the mayor and all of that to kind of liberate the free elections in Athens. So,
like, it's not like these stories just came out of our imaginations. You know, stories are a very fundamental human thing, and we talked about that last podcast, the Lost podcast. Archaeologists will discover in the future, but stories are innate, and everything. Everything in any story is going to have some root in human experience. Now, that human experience might be dreams or drugs, but at some point, every element, you can trace it back to something that a human has seen or felt or heard. That's one reason I like old sorts of magic and really fey kinds of elves. You know, D&D elves are sort of, I mean, I think they honestly have more to do with aliens, with conceptions of mid-20th century conceptions of aliens than they do with 20th century conceptions of fairies.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought of it that way before, but I think you have a point there. That's that's a really interesting way to look at that.
But the ways that humans dealt with forces beyond their control and with people that they just couldn't understand, and so you go to, there's places in England where there are fairy paths and just this sort of worn out area between buildings. It's where nobody walks, but they just kind of leave it alone so the fairies can walk there. And, you know, leaving milk out for the brownies, and they'll do you a good deed probably, but maybe they'll do something totally wrecks you. And you know, I think a lot of that has to do with conquering a country, and the old people are still hanging around somewhere when they don't talk like you, and they don't have the same set of moral values as you, and you're kind of scared you're going to tick them off, and they probably feel the same way about you. You know, added to that, there are actually things that we don't understand, actually forces out there that we don't get, and presumptuous of us, and, you know, don't come away from this thing that I think this is all. This all has a material explanation.
Yeah, that's one of the things that really gets me about modern fiction. Any time I read it, is that everything has to have, at the end of the day, some kind of scientific material explanation. You know, even something like fairies. That's one of the things that I really like about Jim Butcher. with the Harry Dresden books, is that when he brings up fairies and magical creatures, there isn't any, like, he doesn't try to explain this with science. This is a no shit magical creature that is talking to Harry Dresden right here.
Everything's got an explanation. And I'm not saying that everything has an explanation. I'm saying that everything has an experience. Everything has a witness, I guess. So good fantasy brings us in contact with these unexplainable things. And, you know, I mean, maybe they are all explainable. I don't think so. I think it is possible that there are, you know, ghosts and fairies and stuff out there.
Yeah, no,
just out of intellectual humility. Just because there might be a more plausible explanation for something, doesn't mean that the implausible explanation is false.
Yeah, and with certain stuff, I mean, it's, you know, people like to get into that intellectual trap of, you know, well, you can't disprove this, therefore Occam's razor kind of thing. But, you know, there's a lot of stories, particularly in certain areas like England and Ireland and places like that, about fairies, and there's a lot of little customs that people still abide by, you know, depending on where you go. And it's like, you know, you don't step into the fairy circle, the little ring of mushrooms in the woods. You leave that alone. You know, you don't do certain things. You don't wander certain places at night. You know, and that's because these things that we can't explain have happened there to somebody before. So people just learn to avoid it. And maybe it does have a mundane explanation. But there is the possibility that the supernatural is something that exists.
It's that unknown that we try as fantasy authors, and I use the term fantasy in a very broad sense. I don't really use romance as much because so another very good word, but as fantasists, you know, it doesn't matter if you're writing about unknown aliens or about unknown elves or about, you know, some completely strange and new secondary world that only has a very tenuous relationship to anybody's experience. What we're doing is we're providing an experience with the unknown. And when you think about it, why is it so easy to suspend your disbelief for fantasy? People, you know, hear a fantasy premise and think, well, that could never happen. Why would I be interested in that? And, you know, some people do. But it's still incredibly widespread for stories to have fantastic elements.
Yeah, that's why I don't really make a distinction between fantasy and science fiction anymore. You know, it's faster than light travel might as well be magic. You know, you can make up BS technological explanations for it, but at the end of the day, that's something that humans cannot do. It's just as mystical and magical as throwing a fireball. You know,
right.
So having this, and, when you read about distinction between them, I really don't see as being useful. Especially since when you combine them, you get a lot of really fun story ideas.
And you know, you can't have too many cooks around the broth. Well, some people can, some people really can't, but you can. And yeah, these are all ways to bring people experiences they wouldn't have had in real life.
And bring that element of wonder into people's lives that they don't have in, you know, their mundane existence. Like, I've got this post that I'm planning on putting up tomorrow that's basically against realism. And in it, I'm making the point that realism is what kills fantasy and science fiction. Like, with horror, you get a little bit of leeway there because you can make the mundane horrendous and terrifying. But, you know, with fantasy and science fiction, if you want to inject realism into that, you're going to kill what makes those genres special.
Before we go any further, why don't you give your definition of realism?
I'm using the one from Merriam-Webster, which basically, like, if you give me a second, I can get that. I shut down my browser. But if you give me a second here, I'll pull this up. The one that I'm using is the Merriam-Webster definition, which I've got right here. The theory or practice of fidelity in art and literature to nature or to real life and to accurate representation without idealization.
So I think, I think in the normal usage of it, it doesn't refer to being the opposite of fantasy as much as, I guess, the opposite of propaganda.
That's an interesting distinction, because that isn't at all how I, like, when I wrote this post, I wasn't thinking at all about propaganda. I was thinking about, like, you know, if your magic system has to have a metaphysical explanation, or if your technology in your science fiction world all has to, like, if you have to explain how the laser weapons work. And shit like that. It just kind of, it sucks a little bit of the wonder out of it. It leaves the audience, well, okay, now we have an explanation for this. So it's not as special as it is if it did not have this explanation, if it was left unknown, you know?
I think, I mean, rather than, I guess propaganda is one way to put it, but in this very broad sense of propaganda, like, you know what impressionist paintings look like, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where just the colors are all over the place and it's all very grand and it doesn't always look like that in real life. Realism is more like those old Dutch paintings of weddings where it's, you know, you can see all the dirt and it's all, you know, sort of, you know, a lot closer to a photograph. I mean, what you're going at is this things unexplained for the purpose of a mystery. And you're in support of leaving a lot of things unexplained. And I mean, I can see the point of that.
I'm sensing a butt coming.
Well, they're always a big butt.
We wouldn't have it any other way on this show.
And I know we've disagreed about this in the past, but there's something called verisimilitude.
Yeah.
The point of verisimilitude isn't to explain away everything. The point of verisimilitude is to that would have taken you out of the story. Say in the movie.
You broke up a little bit there. Is to do what that would have taken you out of the story?
Answer the questions that would have taken you out of the story.
Okay.
Movie Interstellar. You know, early on, they launch into space on their little space shuttle thing. And you can see they've got big old booster packs strapped to the outside. Color was marketed as being very, very true to the science. They talked about how the special effects team won an award for doing the black hole math necessary to figure out what the black hole, the gravity lensing around a black hole would look like. So you go in there and you expect things to be very, very solid. Go through the wormhole and they're checking out these planets and they land on a planet that's got it's so close to the wormhole that they've got incredible time dilation and it's taken them years and a few minutes. That's the planet with the giant waves and they survive the giant wave and
one of their people.
And they take off in their little space shuttle and they go into orbit on this planet that's been stated to have gravity slightly higher than Earth's. They just take off from the surface and they go into orbit and they leave the black hole's gravity well that was had this incredible time dilation on it. And they just go back to their space station and they don't talk about how they did that.
Yeah. I seem to remember that happening. It's been a while since I watched Interstellar, but yeah. I
spent the rest of the movie thinking about that. Rest of the movie. I mean, if they like,
it's kind of one of those immersion breaking things where it's like, okay, well, we were sticking so close to the science here. You know, why do we suddenly have this bit of seeming magic coming in and, you know, allowing them to do this wondrous thing?
I didn't care about it when in Gravity. Gravity didn't have accurate science at all. I mean, it had all the space stations be on the same orbit. Very, way too easy to hop from one space station to the next. But I didn't expect it to be accurate. I expected it to be poetic. A story about humans not being suited for space. And it really drives that home well. And
maybe that's the heart of the issue is what people are expecting when they come to a story. You know, when you hear about a movie like Interstellar and it's like, okay, well, they have done all of their research and they're trying to cleave as close to the science, as possible. And then they have that one moment where it's like, okay, this is obviously not how things are done, you know, scientifically speaking. It kind of draws you out of it. But when you have a movie that is not presenting any of that kind of, verisimilitude, you're far less likely to question something like that. Like Star Wars. Star Wars doesn't have that level of verisimilitude. There's no sound in space. The lasers don't go weep weep when you shoot them in a vacuum. But
at the same time, there's a lot of verisimilitude and accuracy when it's add to a story. There's a lot that it can solidify the fantasy. You can feel like you're part of it in a way that you really wouldn't in a story that just threw verisimilitude out of the window, like the anime Planetes.
Oh, this is one I haven't seen before.
And a very accurate zero gravity mechanics, and I've had arguments with Ashes about that. Have an argument, you know, about, you know, where's the center of gravity when this guy does a judo throw on someone else in midair.
Like when they're flying through the air and the guy just grabs somebody and throws them.
He loses a little bit of momentum, or he gains momentum in a different direction, and that really helps. Realize that you're in space in a way that if they just like had everywhere have gravity, like that's what the Expanse does. They don't want to put everyone on wires all the time, so they show people, you know, very obviously clicking their heels and turning on their magnet boots, and then they just act like they're in gravity,
right? Because it's functionally the same thing.
But they don't have their hair floating, and they don't leave things in the air to grab them later.
Oh, so there's that. They don't have that attention to detail. So they have like the magnet boots, but they don't have all of the trappings that you would expect in a zero G environment.
They're just hand waving that away. I think in the novels they were just floating around, but it's a budget saving measure for the TV show, which is understandable. As much verisimilitude as if you actually had people that were living in free fall. And that's what verisimilitude can add. It can really strengthen the fantasy.
It's the little details that ground a person in the story so that they're willing to accept the shit that they just can't explain.
Yeah, and Planetes has that sort of thing. It's a very spiritual story. You know, materialistic things happening. It's about how we can't explain what's going on. We can't really explain what's going on with ourselves. Story is about one character being isolated from the other characters. I mean, socially, he cuts himself off to go pursue his goal, but you know, he forgets that we're connected, and maybe supernatural, maybe not, elements that are in there, you know, serve this very human story. Expanse has some things that you can't explain because they're aliens or something, but. it's a very novel sort of story. We're expected to believe that we're seeing the inner workings of power in these space nations and there are only three space nations, and things move very methodically, and you can see a hint laid here and it gets picked up there and focused.
That was one of the things that I liked about Babylon 5 was that it was very tightly focused, and it had the callbacks, like stuff that happens in the first season has an effect on the final season. But they also had, you know, shit that you just couldn't explain. Like the gravity on the space station was explained by, okay, they have this big thing that spins around the space station that generates the gravity.
Fine. That was pretty neat that they showed, you know, the humans couldn't generate artificial gravity, so they used a centrifugal. You know, just a neat little touch like that.
Yeah.
Made it a little easier to forgive possible other breaches, and they didn't really make the heart of the story. It was, you know, about characters and their interactions.
Right. Like a throwaway line kind of explains some of this stuff. Like I remember, I never actually saw the movie, but it was a line from Thank You for Smoking. where they were talking about getting cigarettes into a science fiction movie. And the guy brought up the problem with, well, if this is a pure oxygen environment, you know, wouldn't lighting up a lighter blow up the whole ship? You know, like, wouldn't there be this huge explosion? And the guy behind the desk, the executive for the cigarette company, I guess, like I say, I haven't watched the movie, but he says, well, that's just like one line of dialogue, you know. So, oh, thank God we invented the blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, okay, our characters can smoke in a space station now.
You know, that's one way to do it. Or a neater way to do it is to actually show them putting little filters on their cigarettes or something. Little spark filters or something. I don't know.
But yeah, or nowadays we have like e-cigarettes and shit like that, so problem solved.
But you know, you do little neat things like that. And 2001: A Space Odyssey, for however boring the plot was, you see little details like that. So Stanley Kubrick was very, very detail oriented, and you see those little adjustments to free fall life all over the place, and they really kind of put you in the mindset that you're in this. These extrapolation of space travel, and so that's what when I talk about how great verisimilitude is, I don't mean making.
You don't mean making everything as realistic as possible.
I especially don't mean this faux realism where no one can actually be a hero.
I'm sorry. Explain that term. That's something that I'm unfamiliar with.
Faux realism, where
faux realism. Okay,
you know, Joe Abercrombie style stuff, where everyone is edgy and grim because it's edgy and grim medieval days, and everyone aims to just want to be a hero. He's actually trying to sell something or something like that,
or is like and, a complete fucking sociopath, like in some of N.K. Jemisin's books.
Human realism, where there aren't actually any heroes, because to be a hero, you have to like mess with the trolley problem or something like that.
Or you have to be like extraordinary beyond the capability of a normal man kind of thing. Like Spider-Man or something, or Captain America.
Captain America are much more traditional hero characters. They don't have that dork age sort of thing to them.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like in the sense that Captain America has the super soldier serum, so he's able to go far beyond what a normal man would be able to do. Therefore, he's allowed to be a hero because he's not a normal man. A normal man can't be a hero. So, in stories that are primarily concerned with just normal people, there can be no heroes.
You can take this and put it into fantastic fiction, and that's a lot of what we're I wouldn't say we're up against because they're not actually that relevant, but a lot of what the people that get a lot of press in fantasy and science fiction do is they'll have someone like Captain America, but his super soldier serum will make it so he doesn't relate to normal people anymore, or maybe he thinks that everyone around him is as strong as he is, you know, and so he accidentally breaks someone's arm and he finds himself drifting away and he doesn't care as much.
Oh, so the Dr. Manhattan archetype.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Watchmen showed a lot of ways not to do things.
Now, you definitely have a point. I mean, there's a reason that people resonated with Rorschach more than any other character in that graphic novel.
Because he wants to do the right thing, no matter what. And we look up to that. You look at Rorschach and you think, I want to be that uncompromising. At Night Owl and think, I want to be midlife crisis and ED and wasting my money trying to save the world and failing. You know, you don't look at Dr. Manhattan and think, I want to be of godlike regard and not care about anything.
And move to fucking Mars and completely ignore all of the struggles that humanity are going through until, you know, some chick drags you back.
Yeah. You don't look at that and think I want to be like that. But you know, Marvel characters, for all their faults, you can want to have the sort of respect that you can want to have the respect that Captain America gets. And you know, I can do this all day, even when he doesn't have the super soldier serum, he just won't quit.
Yeah, or someone like Spider-Man, who routinely gets the shit kicked out of him. He still stands up and does the right thing because he's a hero, and that's what he does.
There are actually people like that. Can you believe it?
Yeah, it's shocking. I know.
There are a lot of people like that. And to make your work realistic, I think there's a lot of verisimilitude. Well, no, I mean, that's the wrong way to put it. There is verisimilitude in making your characters heroic. The reason we started writing about heroes was because we saw heroes. So wanted to lie to people that there were heroes. It's because there are actually people like that, that are really that good.
Yeah, and that's a point that I actually make in this. I'm pretty sure I make it in this screed here. Is that, you know, these people say that we can't have actual heroes despite the glut of them in actual history. You know, there's plenty of historical figures that are heroic in some fashion.
And some people will try to find a fault in every one of them and be like, oh, this one kept slaves and you know, and this one kept concubines or something.
It's like, oh my God, nobody's perfect. You've cracked the fucking Da Vinci Code. Congratulations, Sherlock.
At the same time, those are the ones that get press. Those are the ones that get noise. Because they're, you know, who knows about the other ones that they just work problems with.
Yeah,
you know they're not gonna post their negative results. Oh, we tried to find something wrong with this hero, but he was, you know, he was too squeaky clean.
that's why whenever they get into these industries like comic books, they try to tear down these squeaky clean heroes, or you know, bring in other heroes to replace them that are not so squeaky clean. Like, for example, Iron Man. Like, Iron Man has a drinking problem, but at the end of the day, he's, you know, still a good man, and he tries to save people as much as possible. And then you get, like, Riri Williams, who's a total fucking sociopath. Just, like, absolutely batshit out there, not at all a hero. It just... I don't know. I think it strikes to this attitude that's kind of taken over culture nowadays. And I don't know if we were meaning to get into this kind of stuff, but like ever since, I want to say the 40s, when this kind of stuff, this over fixation on, I guess, a Marxist interpretation of verisimilitude, where there are no great men, there is only the collective kind of thing, has kind of crept out from science fiction and fantasy into the rest of the culture, and has just kind of completely infected it, so that, like, even in Star Wars, for God's sake, Finn isn't able to make the heroic sacrifice and do a good deed. No, Rose Tycho has to slam him out of the way, you know, and somehow they go on and save the day, but Finn's not allowed to be a hero. He's not allowed to have that heroic sacrifice for some reason.
Well, I mean, that's just an insult to Marxists. At least they hero worship Stalin and Mao.
Okay, you got me there. You got me there.
I won't claim to know the genealogy of this idea, but it is spread. It's this idea that to be grown up and mature, you can't have people that are good. And I suspect that a lot of the authors just aren't that good of people. Standout, super moral guy writing amoral heroes.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem... It doesn't seem maybe, to click.
Maybe that's his one vice.
I mean, it's entirely possible that George R. R. Martin is, you know, the nicest guy you could ever hope to meet, and he has a real, true sense of heroism deep down inside, but you would never know that from reading Game of Thrones.
And, I mean, I guess one of the issues I see with Pulp Rev right now is concentrating on the wrong opponents. Like, we've been making fun of Cat Rambo a lot. In our secret conspiracies, because she released a new book, is some sort of a fantasy love triangle thingy. I'm not sure exactly what tradition she's trying to break down in it. There were fairy tales she was making. She was going at. I don't know. Mm. Does not seem to be selling very well, and she is the president of the Science Fiction Writers of America. This august body that's been presided over by me pull up the list really quick.
I mean, shit, I think Jerry Purnell was the president of CIFWA for a while.
Let's see. Paul Anderson, Frederick Pohl, Jack Williamson, Jane Yolen, Greg Baird, Gordon R. Dixon, Robert Silverberg, Joe Haldeman. These are some really good, really well-respected authors. Silverberg was the second president, and he still makes a lot of sales. I mean, Damon Knight was the first president, and we don't really speak his name.
Yeah.
But,
the grudge I have against Damon Knight.
And some of these names you don't remember anymore. But
I mean, like Haldeman, the Forever War still sells.
People weren't Kindle ebook authors. Feels like there's this tiny little cabal that's taken over these organizations and inflated self-importance. And it's not a very kind thing for us to do to their inflated egos to play along. Well, I don't think we should treat them like these great adversaries, because we're not competing for readers with them. Cat Rambo's...
You have a point there. I mean, like...
And close friends aren't going to buy us, you know. You know, her readership.
Like I was talking with Christopher Warren the other day about the sales for Dimension Bucket Media books, and because we're relatively unknown, you know, outside of a small circle, the sales aren't spectacular. They aren't even what I would class as good. We're selling about as many copies on average of our Darkest of Dreams anthology as what I hear Kat Rambo is selling of her new book. And that's all kinds of sad, especially since nobody knows who the fuck we are.
We got over 100 sales of the Pulp Rev sampler, and we gave that away.
That's just...
Like, well, yeah, and
the president of the Science Fiction Writers Association cannot sell more than a bunch of fucking yahoos on the internet just writing fun stories and giving them away basically for free. That speaks to how powerful that organization truly is.
And that speaks to us for talking about them all the time, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And play their games. And just let them play act with these things they've inherited from the old science fiction greats. We're a new thing. We're a new thing in the land. We're different. We're not competing with them. We're
supplanting them.
I mean, we're not even supplanting them. They've got a niche. They're happy with it. They're not really trying to expand that much. They're all sort of shrinking down to the same level. You know, Scalzi had that multi-million deal, and he's sort of shrinking down. You know, issue, and we're going for the pulp market. We're going for people that are reading stuff, you know, on the train to their manly construction jobs. We're going for these voracious Kindle readers that are too sick to leave the house, and they just read all the time, but they sort of wish they're reading something better. You know, we're going for people that want to read more, but they don't know what's out there, and so they just watch Netflix. Well, truckers who want good audiobooks. There's this huge spread of people we could be out there reaching. And if we confine ourselves to what SFWA and their associated goons, if we confine ourselves to the sort of markets they go after, you know, we're shooting ourselves in the foot.
No, you know, I agree with you there. It's just I don't think that we're necessarily confining ourselves to. Like most of the discussion I see in the pulp rev circles about, you know, CIFWA is pretty much mocking them.
We pity them.
Yeah, but it's pity and it's mockery, and we're not actually.
Well, it's easy to consider them our main adversary.
Yeah, because they've had so much power for so long.
There is apathy.
How do you mean with apathy?
Just not caring about finding a book to read.
So I think you broke up a little bit. Not care. Who doesn't care about finding a book to read?
regular people, a lot of regular people who maybe they used to read in the past, but they just found themselves enjoying things less and less, and the Hugo Awards meant less and less. And maybe some of these people have read some Castalia House books and didn't quite scratch the itch.
Yeah, and, I think that's another market that we're specifically trying to reach, because I've heard people like Brian Niemeyer talk about how readership...
Oh, we're sort of trying not to touch him too closely so you don't fall into the Castalia ghetto.
But I've heard him talk about how readership for science fiction and fantasy has fallen off in the past few decades. It's just not as big of a market as it used to be. And I think that a lot of those people are people who have enjoyed stuff like Poole Anderson or Robert Howard or Fritz Leiber, and they just don't find the stuff that's coming out now as entertaining. So our goal with that is to kind of bring those people back into the fold and let them know that, yeah, there are people out here who are still writing stories specifically to entertain you.
The greatest pulp authors, and he made the transition into the paperbacks extremely well. We don't talk about the paperbacks a whole lot, but I mean, I guess Poole Anderson is more paperback than pulp. It's all part of pulp forever. We claim all good stories. But anyway, one of these great authors... And Louis L'Amour is an author you'll find like passenger seat of an old cowboy pickup truck. That sort of brand penetration is completely priceless.
You'll also find him in middle school libraries and shit. I remember that they had a ton of Louis L'Amour books in my middle and high schools.
Yeah. Only read Louis L'Amour. And that's because he resonates with them. Their experience is something they trust Louis L'Amour with their time, and they trust him with their hearts. Story with him. They know they're going to have a certain kind of story. He's pretty strict on the genres. He didn't leave cowboys very often. Although, I mean, it was, in his early career, he did write some science fiction, I think.
I'm going to have to look that up, because I've got a couple of Louis L'Amour.
Oh, Michael Shera wrote some science fiction. He's the guy that wrote Gettysburg. So he's really famous for his historical fiction. But, I read this story of one that's fighting an alien on a frontier planet. So, very similar to his regular American history sort of subject. But this crossover between historical writing and science fiction is something else that happened in the pulp era that we don't see too much today. But I guess my point with Louis L'Amour was try being someone that a market, making a brand that can hit a market like that and do a whole lot of good to a whole lot of people. There's a whole lot of light in the world that Louis L'Amour brought. I don't think he could have done it if he hadn't just wrote cowboy stories and if he hadn't had that incredible focus on what made a good cowboy story.
Yeah, I think you have a point there. I mean, I also think there's something to be said for, of course, guys like, Robert E. Howard, who wrote all kinds of random bullshit, just like, sword and sorcery and boxing stories.
I mean, there's always these masculine battles in it. And maybe I'm wrong about L'Amour. Maybe he could have wrote a wider range of things and these old cowboys would still like him. Yeah. You're right.
But I think you're right. We shouldn't be so limited, which is why I'm trying to kind of branch out and do a whole bunch of other, like, oh, here's a mech story. Here's urban fantasy. Here's sword and sorcery. Here's, blah, blah, blah. Insert genre here. It probably makes my writing seem a little bit defocused, but I'm not trying to grab a niche market. I'm trying to appeal to as many people as like good old-fashioned manly adventure stories, whatever form they might take. So
trying to grab the niche market of people that'll read absolutely anything.
Yeah, pretty much. but there was something that we had brought up
long as science fiction and fantasy, because you haven't written straight historical fiction yet.
No, I'm working on it. I'm working on it.
Anyway, what were you saying? I cut you off.
There is a story in the works that's supposed to be historical fiction, but I have to figure out how to write novels first. But no, there was something that we had talked about in the Lost podcast about the pulp rev kind of touting itself as being greater than it was. And I think it's important that we need to touch on that because this isn't something that gets brought up a lot in the discussions that I've seen, like in the Discord or in the Twitter DM groups and stuff like that.
Let's talk about that, but I need to take a break really quick.
Yeah, sure. No problem.
All right, I'm back.
Cool, cool.
About my issue with what seems to be a sort of over-promotion of pulp rep, puffing ourselves up as if we're...
As if we're
inevitable.
I think you cut off there. So puffing ourselves up as if we're inevitable.
We're the next big thing, and you know, look at. Let's all laugh at how bad this last Star Wars movie is, and just kind of kick our feet up and you know, satisfy the knowledge that pulp rev is going to take over.
Yeah, the threat of complacency, basically.
And I think a lot of this has to do with putting up. The regular Torlocks as our opponents, because if it were just us and them, then every other book on Amazon got wiped, we'd probably be a little bit more popular with them, even at our current quality level. But we're not. Like, we were talking about that initiative Amazon was having with comic book stores, and in the next year or so, they might totally reset the price of comic books and start paying a whole bunch of new creators and testing the waters with a bunch of different series, shaking up the real corrupt and insular comic book market. And like that could just come out of left field and sweep us away. And we're not the only ones making heroism anymore. Because we aren't the only ones making heroism right now. I mean, Bane Books exists. You know, Larry Correa exists. A lot of randos on Kindle that we've never heard of and we're never going to hear of are writing about heroism. But, you know, maybe some of us would get picked up as writers in this new Amazon initiative and we'd go along with that on our merry way. And pulp rev was this sort of neat thing that we honed our talents with at some point. And, bring back the pulp spirit. I think I'm not sure even how much this attitude would hurt that. Come to think of it, you know, I don't like it. Unless it's absolutely true, which is what I do all the time.
What do you mean, the attitude that pulp rev is inevitable, or?
Well, and that it's better than it is. I mean, I'm a very harsh critic. And I've, tone it down a bit for the sake of friendship, but I am pretty the actual quality of the stuff we've made so far. There's not a whole lot of it that I would just sit down and read if it wasn't my friends making it. And so
I suppose that's understandable. I mean, like, well, the thing that I brought up in that last kerfuffle was that a lot of these people have just started writing, you know, yeah. or they've been writing for a while, but they've never actually been writing seriously. Like, I've been writing my entire life, but I've never been writing seriously like I am now, like actually trying to hone the craft with explicit goals in mind and reading other authors and taking notes on their style and trying to work it into my own and in ways that makes my own fiction better. But a lot of these people have just started writing within the past couple of years. So we can't really expect them to be, you know, the bomb shit diggity right now. And I think that you have a point. I want to get that out. I think that you have a point is that we shouldn't be touting all of this stuff as the best fucking thing ever when it's just kind of self-evident.
Finally a return to having manly men and womanly women. Finally, we now have these things again. And, you know, people have been reading paperbacks since the 60s. Like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about?
Yeah, it's like, you know, Deathlands is a thing that exists. or
yeah, exactly.
Other, like, I recently got into a conversation with a couple of people on Twitter that turned me on to, like, the Max Bolan novels and the Destroyer series and stuff like that. It's like, you know, this attitude kind of went from the pulp magazines into the mass production print paperback. And there were plenty of people doing this kind of stuff on through the 70s and the 80s and shit like that after the pulps kind of went out of style and died away. It doesn't have the exact same feel as the pulps, I don't think. But
no, it doesn't have this wholeness that they had. And there's been a lot of degeneration since then, which is why I'm sticking with the movement, you know, because there's a whole so much potential. But if we're just about to take over the world, that's one thing. If we're a bunch of new writers that can't be expected to take over the world is another thing. But let's not try to be both. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I went out and I went after this attitude of us being, you know, such hot stuff. And I got responded to with, well, you know, we're our hot stuff, but we're also really new for not being as hot as we say we are. And you know, that sort of contradiction, just my poor engineer's heart just can't take it.
maybe I had phrased things badly. I don't think that we are the hottest shit.
You know, you don't, and I know you don't. You just brought up a knowledge of the other stuff that's going on, which is great. It's great.
But I think that we have serious potential to become the hottest shit. We just have to work hard.
We absolutely do. We know that the pulps aren't just heroism and loincloths. We know there's more depth to them.
Doesn't Kurosawa know it at this point?
We know there's yeah. You know, reading what he publishes, I can't imagine what he gets submitted. You know, just. I had Slush open for a week on this pulp ref sampler, and a lot of people don't get it.
I remember back when he was taking open submissions for the ones that are coming out now, he had to actively put out announcements on his website that was like, look, guys, do not send me any more loincloth-clad barbarian swinging sword stories. Please. I have enough.
A lot of my problem a while ago was... We have Pulp Rev is, in my opinion, it's a movement made by people that were astounded to find out that the stereotypes of the pulps were false. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it's colored, of course, by the puppies movement and this reaction against the puppies movement. And a lot of people that were pro puppies are now Pulp Rev, and so there's a lot of that attitude still around. Cadre, I would say, that we're all about celebrating the pulp stereotypes. And even in a lot of my disagreements with you, it seemed like you've kind of had this attitude of, yeah, they were mindless, but that's great. Yeah, they were uncomplicated and solving things through strength and very, very stereotypical, but that's good. We love that. That's what we need more of.
Well, maybe I should take this time to kind of explain my position on that, because, you know, we've talked about this in, like, Discord chats and stuff like that, and via Twitter, but I we haven't actually sat down and talked about it, and I'm glad that you brought it up, actually, because I'm going through and I'm reading the Conan stories right now. And yes, there is, you know, deep philosophy and a little bit of political commentary. And
I wouldn't even say philosophy and politics are the big things. I mean, there's a lot of deep character stuff going on too.
Yeah, that too. You know,
like the being way smart.
The way that Howard structures his characters and brings them into being and presents them to you, like all of that is very, very interesting, especially if you're a writer looking at the technical aspects of writing and trying to further your own craft. But so far as just entertaining stories go, you can read a Conan story and not worry about any of that and still be entertained by it. So it's all right if you have that stuff in your
There's
story.
There's a reason that a Conan story and not another story, isn't there?
Oh, most definitely.
Can entertain. Deathlands entertains.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Clive Cussler entertains.
True.
You're reading him because he entertains on so many different levels. Because he satisfies. He doesn't just merely entertain.
I think that that's something that I haven't considered before. Like that, you have this neat trick that you do where you will just use one word and I'll be like, huh, damn. But yeah, like satisfies. That I think is a good word for it, because the Conan stories do satisfy in a way that something like Dragonlance or Drizzt-Do'Urden doesn't. Yes, those are entertaining stories, but at the same time, Conan is just on another level. And I don't know if I can properly articulate why he's on that other level.
You know, it's not just because it does the action better. There's something deeper about it. And that's this thing that I keep bringing up. And I keep posting that Thomas Diaz quote. I posted it so many times because it handles so many things. Conan is about so much. You know, even like Queen of the Black Coast, it's a pirate story. Conan shacks up with a pirate and I'm going to spoil it for you. And no, I'm kidding.
Oh, no, go ahead. I'm gonna fucking read it anyway, dude. If you want to spoil it for me, go for it. Okay. The story's a goddamn hundred years old now.
Talked about a lot, but read a few others. But Queen of the Black Coast is Conan is escaping something that we never hear about, but we just trust him to be some shenanigan. And no, he gets on board a ship.
He got arrested because he was in some shenanigans with some thief or something like that, and he wound up killing the judge and fighting his way out of the courtroom and stealing a horse and then jumping on a boat.
We don't go into a whole lot of detail about it, and it's all paragraphs.
Yeah, like what I gave you is basically what Robert E. Howard describes from Conan's, you know, telling of what happened to him.
The basic telling of the story. He shacks up with a pirate queen. They raid a lot of places and do a lot of pirate stuff. And then they this ancient river that's everyone's scared of because they think there's treasure there. And they find treasure, but they also find like bat people that kill everybody. And Conan has to fight the bat people and make it out alive. And a lot of people could write about that. People do.
Yeah, there's nothing inherently special about that story, which is why you see so many Conan pastiches out there.
But Conan is special. I mean, he's smart. That's the first thing people forget about him. Conan is very smart.
Right.
And the Queen of the Black Coast, she's more than a match for him. And forces of ancient evil are way more than a match for either of them, and it's really a fluke that anyone made it out alive at all. And you know, on top of that, it's very, very beautifully written.
Mm-hmm.
Evocative.
Most definitely. I keep coming back to this, but Robert E. Howard is quite possibly the best author I've ever read, so far as like evocative language goes. He puts pictures into your head so well.
He doesn't just put pictures in it, because they aren't bare descriptions. They're emotional. He uses words that bring out emotional responses.
Right, like his constant, you know, the more you read of Howard, the more you notice this, but his constant comparisons of people to animals, like Conan's pantherous stride, or he grinned like a wolf, or something like that, you know. When he uses a phrase like that, you know exactly what he means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's just a lot that goes into it, and there's a lot of study that we can make of it, and that's half of our mission as Pulp Forever, isn't to make new stuff, but to read the old stuff, to find out what else that we're missing. And we found a lot of really neat stuff. There's a lot of coming out of the Pulp Forever movement that, you know, someone just grinds their axe on this guy being awesome, and no one's heard about him in 50 years. A lot of them are more famous than we give them credit for. They've been republished in the paperbacks and stuff before that one power company ruling ruined everything. But yeah, the
There's a lot that goes into it, and it's not just that he wrote an entertaining story. It's that he was able to write a story more entertaining, more satisfying, more fulfilling than most anyone else we've ever read. And we want to emulate that mentality I accuse people of having. You know what cargo cults are, right?
What are? Cargo cults.
Yeah, the New Guinea tribesmen.
I know what you're talking about. but go ahead and break it down for people that aren't familiar.
For the listeners, New Guinea tribesmen encountering the Allies in the Second World War would some of them, it was their first encounter with the outside world at all. They were very primitive tribes, and these planes come in, and they've got a whole bunch of supplies on them. And these strange men distribute these blankets to the tribesmen and distribute this food. And it's gods or angels or something, just some supernatural thing outside of their control. I mean, they probably wrote some really pulpy stories about it, right, in their oral histories. And to emulate the magic that these people used to bring these supplies, or they called it cargo in their pidgin language.
Oh, okay.
But so to this day, they will make bamboo planes and make airstrips and set up little radio shacks, and they've got coconut headphones. Who knows how much faith they actually have that's going to do something? I don't know. Maybe some of them, it's just a Christmas and Easter thing. But they're copying the form and missing the substance.
Right. And you're worried that that's part of what Paul Perev is doing.
I mean, that's what I would call the anti-intellectual fringe of pulp rev, right? It's the people that don't know that we're not new pulp think that we rediscovered how to make a fist fight.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm projecting something onto people. But sometimes it feels like we think that we dug up these ancient scrolls that said, you know, we open it up and it says in 55 point impact, just make it entertaining.
And you know,
why did I think of that?
And I'm guilty of this. Like I'm not going to pretend that this isn't an excoriation
attack on you. It is.
But I welcome it, and it is justified, because I do have this bent against intellectualism, I guess, if you want to put it that way. Because usually when I encounter intellectual fiction or fantasy or sci-fi that tries to be intellectual about the way that it presents itself, it usually entails, you know, some form of the, with sci-fi, you can only have one piece of magic in your science fiction story. Or it has to be more concerned with philosophy, like how Starship Troopers, as much as I love the book, is political philosophy dressed up as science fiction. It can be entertaining, but at the same time, if you're not devoted or at least interested in what Robert Heinlein is talking about in Starship Troopers, you know, so far as the political philosophy goes, you're going to get bored with that book quick.
I mean, I think what you're getting at, it isn't that there is intellectualism in a book. It's that there is only intellectualism.
Yes. Yes. And maybe I overcorrect too hard in the opposite direction. I'm willing to admit that.
On the one hand, there is Arthur C. Clarke with his very overly intellectual and very boring books. And on the other hand, there is Dragonlance with very entertaining and books. But the pulps, what made them special was that they were intellectually satisfying at the same time as they were incredibly entertaining. And that intellectual satisfaction made the entertainment more visceral, and that entertainment made the intellectual satisfaction more satisfying. Other. You know, and that's what we mean by holistic, is it touches on all these different aspects, and especially something that you'll find Often in a pulp story, people will have grandparents. They won't be these Disney-fied waifs with no parents nearly as much. And it's not like Conan's parents ever show up, but you know he's got them.
Yeah. Yeah, even if he did leave them when he was 15 or whatever, you know, he has parents, obviously.
When you meet people, they tend to be either more complete in their social units, or they are obviously suffering because they're not, I guess. And this is a really undeveloped thought, and maybe we can cut it from the podcast. I don't know.
I think you have something there, because you know, when you meet somebody who knows both of their parents, it's a very different feeling than when you meet somebody who, you know, never knew their father or never knew their mother or something like that. You know, there's something off about this person. They're not as complete as they would be if they had that full familial relationship.
Yeah, there's this wholeness, this completeness that I think a lot of it actually just comes from being written by people that are more whole and complete.
I think you have a point.
Robert E. Howard was a young suicide.
Yeah, a very young suicide, but
he still knew about life. He still knew about this length and breadth of life, and he put that into his stories. And even his suicide, it wasn't necessarily because he was insane. His love for his mother was so strong. And he couldn't imagine a world without her. That's less of a suicide because he was put on SSRIs and more of a classical sort of thing. It's a very epic sort of way to go.
It's a very what sort of way to go?
In like the style of the sagas. a way to go.
Oh, okay. So like the old Grecian myths and things.
Yeah, yeah. He had a very mythic is a good word. It's a very mythic way to go.
Most definitely. Like I say, I'm reading the Blood and Thunder biography, which, by the way, I highly recommend. The guy who don't get distracted by the introduction. The guy who wrote the introduction is a fucking twat. But the guy who wrote the biography, like, devoted his a goodly portion of his life to understanding and cataloging Robert E. Howard's. And yeah, you just get a very different picture of this man that when you hear, that you do when you hear someone like Damon Knight talk about him. Or somebody who's, oh, he was just so racist and sexist and horrible. It's like, well, no, he had a black housekeeper that would sit around and tell him stories, and a lot of those stories translated into his fiction later on.
Well, what was I going for? Fight Club, right?
Okay, well, you can talk about Fight Club if you want.
Well, I just that speaks. We're a generation of men raised by women.
Mm. No, I
never knew it. Howard was the archetype Tyler Durden was trying to find.
Yeah, definitely.
He had been punched in the face. He didn't
Several
have to.
Times.
He went and the usual way to get punched in the face. He didn't have to invent some nerdy new basement thing to get punched in the face. You know, Fight Club is about the invention of religion from first principles.
Mm-hmm.
It's chaos worship. The darkness, death, pain, to these things because you've never heard of them before, and trying to learn more about them and ending up worshiping them. And I'm not even saying that in a negative way. You know, it's sort of a beautiful thing watching these people rediscover their ancestors. But anyway, a lot of modern fiction is lacking because the people that write it are not whole.
They've never been punched
people.
In the face.
They've never been punched in the face. there's this starving artist stereotype, tortured artist stereotype that people fall into and think it means something. When the reason that a tortured artist great work is because he knows what he's missing.
Okay, so just to kind of extrapolate from this idea, a tortured artist who creates great work about, let's say, father and son relationship dynamics, does that because that's something that he never had.
Because he knows it's something, because it's something he never had, but he knows what it's like to have it. He knows people that have had it. He's got experience around it.
So he had friends who had fathers in their lives, or he knew his father, but he died when the guy was very young. And
that's one aspect of it. Or maybe
I'm just kind of tossing out examples, but
maybe it's someone who had wholeness in their life, but then they just went crazy. Lost. Not, they got kicked in the head by a horse or something. I don't know. and they've got depression. You know, depression is very, very fertile ground. Not necessarily the fault of anyone that someone's got depression, but they're not just writing about their depression. They know what they've lost. The authors do not know what they've lost. They don't know that they're missing anything. In a lot of cases, they fall on these very incomplete dogmas of racism and sexism.
Mm.
They are, could not be fertile ground for stories. But there were some Harlem Renaissance authors that wrote some really neat stuff, but at it from a cargo cult perspective of that if you just put in the racism and sexism, equality will follow. Very whole story.
Right. It's like somebody like R.A. Salvatore trying to do with the Drizzt novels what To Kill a Mockingbird did with the Jim Crow era in America.
And they are doing today. What the Torlocks are doing today does not necessarily mean they're going to write bad fiction. It's not their focus. It's not their politics. It's not their focus on politics that means they're writing bad fiction. Innate and fundamental incompleteness as people. That's my theory. I don't know him personally.
I think that there might be something to that, because I've seen, fiction from people like the Torlocks that has actually been pretty decent. There were several stories in Lightspeed Magazine or Nightmare or the escape artist stuff, escape pod, podcastle, that kind of thing, at certain points there were even a couple of stories that touched me deeply, on a soul level, a metaphysical level. So I don't think it's necessarily the focus on politics, even though politics definitely factored into it, but that was always something. This is why I have such a hate boner for politics in fiction, is that the politics was always something that took me out of the story. There was one episode of Podcastle, I remember, because the story was so good, where this woman was trying to capture a unicorn because someone that she loved was dying, and the unicorn was the way to save her. And there was a guy in the story, and it was like a fucking Lifetime movie. The guy has to be the just most dick, pig-headish motherfucker in the story. And that shit just kind of took me out of it, because there was no real reason for the guy to act that way. I think at one point in the story, he even stabbed the unicorn in the neck with a pocket knife or something like that. It was just it was completely unnecessary. It just dragged me right out of the story. But then the ending finished strong. But that kind of shit just, I think, detracts from the overall effect of the fiction, which is why I have such a distaste for that kind of thing.
Well, and that's something else that might not be bad to touch on, is how their villains tend to be either assigned villains, and they have to do a villainous thing every now and then so you remember that you don't like them, or they're in the heroes and you start to wonder why you're not rooting for them instead, and with these perverse morals. They end up making the Nazis seem like better people. Man of the High Castle, the adaptation, Amazon adaptation, had that problem.
Oh, God, I could not. What? I got 5 minutes into that, including the opening credits cinematic. And for me, I just...
it,
It was very obvious they were not consulting the I Ching for all the decisions concerning the production. And so it just wasn't Man of the High Castle for me. But from what I understand, the most sympathetic character was a Nazi, because he was a good dad and a good man. And they, a Nazi, would counterbalance everything else. And they made their heroes kind of scumbags, because they believed that made them complicated and interesting.
Which is not really at all how the book worked.
I mean, what they actually ended up doing was making a story that was, to many people, very pro-Nazi. That wasn't their intent at all, but they forgot how to make a decent villain. And maybe we can go into that at another time. We've been going on for a little while now. I don't know how much patience people have for your podcasts.
I'm not sure either. I just kind of do it, and then people listen.
Yeah, we had a pretty good curve there with talking about politics and then talking about story and then going back to politics. But yeah, you know, I don't really have my thoughts gathered. We'll talk about villains at another time.
All right. So you want to go ahead and cut it here?
It sounds good. We had a pretty good round table here.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you, everybody at home, for listening along. Thank you, Jesse, for coming on the show. I really do appreciate you taking time out to re-record this damn thing after the technical difficulties of last
time. Even better, after the next re-recording.
maybe we'll get it done that time. But yeah, man, thanks for coming on the show, dude. I really appreciate it. It's been a great conversation. You know, I love talking to you.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you too.
Go ahead and let everybody know where they can find you before we close out.
All right. Well, I'm on Twitter at Jesse Lucas Saga.
That's two S's on Jesse.
Yeah. Jesse. And let's see. I'm on Discord at the Pulp Rev Discord. I check on Pulp Rev Riot every now and then. Actually, we started that after the last podcast. Jim got me interested in actually. And it's not very popular yet, but, you know, I check on it every now and then. You can email me j.abraham.lucas@gmail.com. I'm pretty accessible, pretty easy to talk to.
Your blog, too, right?
I've got a blog, but I haven't updated it in ages. jesseabrahamlucas.blogspot.com. Really ages. I haven't updated it because the pulprev.com blog. And a lot of my when I have blogged, a lot of it's come up there. Well, yeah, I am one of the of pulprev.com.
One of the admins.
Pulprev.com.
All right. Well, yeah, everybody go follow Jesse at all of his different places. And thanks again for coming on the show, man. And we will catch you guys next week. Peace out, everybody. All right. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks again to Jesse for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it. I'm glad we finally got the chance to talk in person, as it were. And I hope that he will come on the podcast again. His links are below in the description, in the show notes, wherever you happen to be listening this on iTunes or the Blogspot or whatever. They will be down there, so go ahead and be sure to follow him, especially on his Twitter, and check out his blog. But now that the podcast is over, I'm going to go ahead and do the sponsor roll, and then I will get out of y'all's hair. So if you like what I do here, the podcast and the interviews and the discussions and the blog posts and the short fiction and the audiobooks and all of that stuff, and you want to help me out, there are a couple of ways that you can do that. Now, the first one is Maker Support. I do have a Maker Support page, but Maker Support has been engaged in a little bit of some kind of shady, not necessarily backdoor dealings, but they weren't as upfront with their customers and their creators as they could have been about certain things. But the Maker Support is up if you want to go over there and help me out. The Patreon is still down. because they're still working out their website, but hopefully they'll get that up here in the next 20 years before Jesus comes back. I also have a Ko-fi, it was spelled K-O-F-I, which is just a little tip jar. So if you want to toss me, I think that it's like $3 or something like that is the way that they do it. It routes it through PayPal, and they don't take a cut. At least that's what they said on their website. So if you want to drop a couple of bucks in the tip jar, throw some shekels in the hat, I would be most appreciative. You can find the button over there on the left-hand side of my website. Just if you want to drop me a little bit of cash for all of the shit that I've been doing lately. Next up, we have the Cat Kimbridge audiobooks, which is some good old military superversive science fiction. It also has a strong female character, if you're into that, but the world is incredibly original, the writing is really good, this guy's stories are written to entertain, first and foremost, not to preach a message, not to get political, or anything like that. So if you're looking for some fun, adventurous short fiction where people actually get into trouble, and it doesn't succumb to DBZ syndrome, where everything gets ratcheted up, and now we have to fight the next god demon boss, then check this out. It's very much like Star Trek meets Firefly. So if that sounds like it would be up your alley, then go and check those books out. I did 6, 7, and 8 in the series. And you don't have to start with number 1. I started with book 7. I would recommend going and getting books 1 through 5. But if you just want to help me out and you just want to hear the books that I've done, then go ahead and pick up the audiobooks for 6, 7, and 8. Next up, we have the Dimension Bucket Media books. Now, check this space in the future, because there's going to be more stuff coming out from us very soon. Christopher Warren's been working on like fucking 5 novels, because God forbid that guy be anything but productive. And I'm looking at coming out with an anthology of my own short fiction here very soon, probably within the next month or two. So keep an eye out for that. But for now, we have Hell's 5-Minute Tales of Horror, which is a collection of spooky microfiction by Hell Richards. And she has done an excellent job bringing these stories together. They are very, very spooky. So if you're into short horror fiction that won't take you more than 5 minutes to read any entry in the book, this is where you want to be. We also have Dimension of Cobwebs, which is a collection of weird fiction from the days when weird fiction was first becoming a thing by grandmasters of the craft. So people like Edgar Allan Poe, H.G. Wells, H.P. Lovecraft, Frank Belknap Long, Hans Heinz Ewers, Bram Stoker, and I think there's one other guy in there, but I can never remember that fool's name. But yeah, if you want to find out where weird fiction came from, this is where you want to look. We also have Darkest of Dreams, which actually just got a little bit of a revamping. We have a new cover, we have some new formatting, we went in and did some editing, and it's altogether a much nicer book. And that should be available on Amazon by the time this podcast goes live. But go ahead and check out Darkest of Dreams if you want to find out how the Dimension Bucket Media crew does horror. So that's myself, Christopher Warren, aka Dimension Bucket, Connor Goff, aka Nightshade, and William Harmer, aka Gentleman Walrus. So if you want to get 4 very different takes on modern horror, go ahead and check this book out. A Man Upstairs is a collection of creepy dark verse by Christopher Warren. It is a collection of freeform poetry, and he neither likes freeform poetry, nor is he a poet. So of course he had to write a book of it, but it's getting pretty good reviews, and people seem to like it. I've enjoyed what I've read of it. And if you're into sometimes funny, mostly spooky horror poetry, this might be what you're looking for. Cracked by Connor Goff, that's C-R-A-C-K-apostrophe-D, is the tale of a man who discovers a horrible secret behind reality and has to figure out what's going on before reality fractures totally around him. And Connor has a very interesting way of writing madness where you're never sure if this is actually happening or if it's just going on in the character's head. So if you're into some good psychological horror, highly recommend Connor's writing. Phoenix on the Sword is the first ever published Conan story by Robert E. Howard, the man himself. So if you want to find out the origins of Conan, you want to see what the world saw the first time Conan was ever introduced anywhere ever, this is the book that you want to pick up, with cover art by the incomparable Kukurio. Aaron Clary is a former banker and economist who blogs at captaincapitalism.blogspot.com and has a consulting business at assholeconsulting.com. So if you have any questions apart from medical or legal advice about life, the universe, and everything, such as should I date this girl, should I take this job, what should I spend my divorce settlement on, that kind of stuff, go ahead and hit up Aaron and he'll give you the straight dope, no bullshit. That's what he's famous for. He also has several books out, a few of which I have done the audiobooks for. So most recently I did Poor Richard's Retirement, which is a treatise. It's a shorter book. It's a shorter book about how it is possible to achieve retirement in today's economic environment for far less than people are telling you that you need. So if you have any questions about retirement, this is where you need to go to get them answered. He also has Enjoy the Decline, which is subtitled Accepting and Living with the Death of the United States, which is basically what it says on the tin. If you're worried about the way that the country is going and you're looking for a set of instructions or advice to help you cope with that, this is exactly where you need to go. This book has informed a lot of my personal philosophy over the past 3 or 4 years. And as always with Aaron Cleary, it is straight dope, no bullshit. And I cannot recommend his work highly enough. He also has Reconnaissance Man, which is about how you shouldn't immediately jump out of high school and into college and into a worthless degree that you're going to wind up racking up a whole shitload of debt for, and you're not going to be able to find a job right out of high school. You need to take some time, cool your jets, save up a little money, go road tripping, figure out what you want to do and where you want to do it at, where's the best place to do it at. And he outlines several places that are very good in this book. He goes over tax laws and how to check and see if there are jobs in your field and things like that. It's a very informative book. I've very much enjoyed it. So go and pick that one up. He also has Curse of the High IQ. Now, I didn't do the audiobook for this, but it's still a very, very good book about how if you have problems such as constant depression or alcoholism, or you're worried about the way that the country is going, or you have crippling anxiety or things like that, or the world just moves too slow for you, it might be because you have a high IQ. It's not all unicorn farts and rainbows when you have a high IQ. Sometimes it causes some problems, and this book is designed to help you deal with them. Now, this is just his hypothesis, but I have read the book, and I've given it to several friends. They've read it, and we think that this idea has legs. It would be nice if there were some actual scientific research into this, but for right now, all we have is Aaron's speculation. But his speculation is pretty damn good. Highly recommended. Next up, we have John E. Boyle. John is an author who has written the excellent novel Queen's Heir. That's H-E-I-R, as in the heir to the queen, not the heir that the queen breeds. This is a fantasy set among the Hittites at the end of the Bronze Age. It is a sword and sorcery novel that has everything you could look for in a sword and sorcery novel, including swords, sorcery, ghosts, werewolves, fire demons, giant armies clashing. It also has high seas adventure and daring escapes and intense combat and training montages and everything that you could look for in a good old-fashioned action story. So go ahead and pick that one up. You can find the link on the right-hand side of my blog, along with links to Aaron Cleary's books. Next up, we have the affiliate accounts. The way the affiliate accounts work is it doesn't cost you any extra, and it doesn't cost the seller any extra. You just click on this link, it takes you to the website, you buy whatever you want, and the website cuts me off a bit of their profits for sending you over there. So if you're going to do any shopping on Amazon.com, I would appreciate it if you would visit my blog first, jimpier138.blogspot.com, and click on the Amazon affiliate link and go buy whatever you want, and then Amazon will shave me off a couple of shekels for helping out their business. So if you want to go buy some of these great books I've been telling you about on Amazon, then I would appreciate it if you would use my affiliate account to do that. Next up, we have Right Stuff Anime. So if you're looking for any kind of anime-affiliated things, anime, manga, toys, they have the Gundam figurines. They also have hats, t-shirts, jackets. I've got a great Dragon Ball Z hat that I wear fucking everywhere. It's become my favorite baseball cap. Very good store. Never had a problem with damaged things showing up. Never had a problem with them being late. The packages are always very well wrapped. And like I said, I've never had a problem with them, and I don't think you will either. So if you're into your weeb shit, this is where you need to go to get it. Next up, we have MyComicShop.com, which is your one-stop shop for all things comic books. So if you're still a Marvel junkie, but you don't want to actually give Marvel money, or DC for that matter, then you can go over here and you can find their books back when they actually published good comic books. And you can get them used so you don't have to give Marvel your money. You can also find newer comic books from like Boom Studios or Antarctic Press, even although I wouldn't recommend you buy Antarctic Press after what's happened with Jawbreakers, but that aside, they also have Alterna Comics, Dark Horse, all kinds of different companies. You can find just about anything here. It's very rare that I'm looking for something and I go to mycomicshop.com and they don't at least have a listing for it that I can want list, and then they'll email me when it comes up for sale. And you guys know me, I'm into some pretty niche stuff like Cadillacs and Dinosaurs and Wildcats and Dinosaurs for Hire and Turok and that kind of thing. They've got it. If you're looking for it, they've probably got it. Next up, we have ads on the blog. So if you want to advertise with JimFear138 Productions, then all you have to do is get in touch with me via the contact form on the left-hand side of the blog, and for $20 a month, you will get an advertisement on the blog right up there at the top where everybody can see it. You will get a post on the blog detailing your thing and where people can go to find it. You will also get posts on my various social media accounts, and you will get a spot in the sponsor role on the podcast, basically what I'm doing right now, right up at the top where everybody will hear your thing first. I'm also willing to do a video and an audio advertisement for you for BitChute, my YouTube channel, your YouTube channel if you have one, podcasts, put it up on your website, wherever you want this thing to go, you can put it. So yeah, if that sounds like something that you would be interested in, just get in touch and we'll get the details hammered out. Lastly, we have the Bandcamp. The Bandcamp is where I'm putting all of my independent audio productions. So, audiobooks that I am not running through Dimension Bucket Media, just things that I'm putting out that I'm doing basically for fun. And watch that space, because there is more coming. I've got some stuff that I'm going to be doing with Dimension Bucket Media here in a little while, but every once in a while I will get a wild hair up my ass and just read a story that I really like. And right now we have The Haunter of the Ring by Robert E. Howard and The Judge's House by Bram Stoker, some good old-fashioned horror stories from the turn of the 20th century. So go and check that out if you like listening to me talk and read you stories and do voice acting. But alright, that is the sponsor roll. Thank you guys very much for listening to the podcast. Thanks, Jesse, again for coming on, and I will catch you guys next week. Peace out, everybody.